The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 165.
Being a practical meerkat with Laura Ann Gilman.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest, obviously, today is Laura Ann Gilman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, so let's start with the now modified first question we ask all new people. I'm not going to ask you what got you into writing. I'm now going to just ask you this question, which is, what is it about the fantasy genre, since you write quite a number of different types of fantasy, what is it that draws you into the genre?
Possibilities, really. So many other genres have very set structures. Mystery has a structure. Romance has a structure. Even science fiction, to a certain degree, has a structure, although not as much. Fantasy lets you do almost anything and lets you propose almost anything. And as a kid who was always sort of pushing the "but why" button, that really appealed to me as a reader first and then as a writer.
That's an interesting way of putting it. As a kid, you were pushing the "why" button.
What can I say? I see something and I go, but why? Why do we have to do that? Why are we doing it that way? Why? My parents got very tired of it.
Do you think that's part of why you became a writer?
No. I think I would have been a writer no matter what. There are too many stories that bounce around in my head. I think that's why I studied history and why I tend to still piss off a lot of people because I'm still asking, but why do we do things that way? But I think writing for me, I don't know. I think that I would have been a writer anyway, but it's tough to separate out. But the why is only part of why I write. There's also the because part of it.
So you mentioned that you studied history. Could you talk a little bit about that? And the kind of obvious question that comes out of that is, in what way did your studying of history influence your writing?
I went into college pretty much. I always knew I was going to go into publishing. I'm second generation publishing, third generation writer. I was pretty narrowly focused. But I went in thinking I was going to be an English major because, well, you know, what else would I do? And about halfway through freshman year, I suddenly realized that it was my history classes that were really fascinating me and digging at my brain. So I ended up with a double major because I tend to overachieve like that. And the thing about history is that it looks at the facts, but it tells stories about the facts. It says, okay, this is what we know, and this is what we don't know, and how do we extrapolate between the two? And that's storytelling at its heart. So I think in a lot of ways, being a history major and having a historian mindset definitely pushed me in the direction of writing, even more than being an English major.
Interesting. I'm sorry, Paul, is that going to
be? That's exactly my question. What period were you more focused, most focused on, Laura?
Focus. Okay, yeah. I wasn't really very focused. I studied a little bit of medieval history because I was doing a lot of medieval lit studies at the same time, and it seemed to, you know, if you're learning to speak Middle English and you're reading Chaucer, that it makes sense to to deal with that. But mainly, actually, American history between 1915 and 1940 was where I ended up doing most of my reading. There was just so much, and by extension, the world history at that time, because there was so much going on in terms of fast-paced change and reactionary behavior that it was both in politics and in social history that it was fascinating. I'm not much from military history. It's much more about social history.
And there's quite a lot going on between 1950 and 1940.
Yes.
A huge amount of changes going on. That's interesting. Okay, so kind of the other question I was isn't specific to The Heart of Briar, which is the book we're going to be talking about today. This is a question I was kind of curious about as because you've written two different types of, well, I say types in a very loose sense, two different types of fantasy. What is maybe more traditional fantasy with the I'm going to mispronounce it, but I'm just going to say Vineart.
Close enough, yeah.
Okay. that particular trilogy, but then you've written more traditional urban fantasy, which, such as with the Paranormal Scene Investigations and the Retrievers series. And what I'm curious is, as a writer, do you find the process for either approaching or writing these two things actually differs, or do you go through a detox moment where you're switching up? That's kind of the question, yeah.
First, I'm amused to hear it described as traditional urban fantasy because it's actually an incredibly new subgenre dating back only to the 1980s, which I guess is a long time now. But in terms of genre, it's actually very new and was considered an upstart and not exactly acceptable among fantasy enthusiasts for a long time. We still get some of that. As to the difference, I do tend to detox, and that's actually a really good phrase for it, between projects, because there is a different mindset, but I do it between all projects, no matter what they are, whether I'm going between short fiction and long fiction. I also write mystery, so if I'm switching between mystery and fantasy, that sort of thing. I put things aside for a little while, like an hour or two, and I try to do something that is completely non-writing related, because I will switch gears and start thinking in a slightly different way. The tones of my different styles need some time between the two. The Vineart War was a much more flowing and lyrical style, whereas the urban fantasy tends to be a little more statico, a little more modern in feel. So I have to get my brain wrapped around that, which probably goes back to the earlier question talking about double major, the fact that I was balancing English and history and I had to switch between the classes and the mindset. I've been doing this for a long time. For me, it seems natural. I know a lot of people are like, how do you do all this? And I'm like, how do you not?
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, even within something like the geek world, the SF and F community, we're bouncing between all kinds of different things, or at least I am, and I think most of Paul and Julia probably do the same thing. We're bouncing between mediums, bouncing between forms and styles and all those kinds of things. Just as fans and readers, and Julia, who's Miss Professional, because she's the Strange Horizons lady on our podcast, who's nominated, by the way. Just thought I'd mention that, Julia. For you.
Always mention nominations. Always.
Yeah.
I got to cash in on this while I still can, because after this weekend, can't do it anymore. So I am officially right now a Hugo nominee.
You can always cash. I still will say Nebula nominated. For the first 6 months, I said it so many times people rolled their eyes. But I will still say Nebula nominated because I am still Nebula nominated. You will always be a Hugo nominee no matter what.
Yes, but right now I'm nominated this year, and even though all the votes are in, theoretically I could still win that award.
Well, there's that. You can still be nominee and a winner.
Yeah. and then I'm going to use that on to advertise the show, Julia, just so you know.
I don't know why you haven't been using that for the last 6 months, Sean.
I don't know. I just didn't feel like sucking out your fame. I wanted to let you simmer in it, you know?
I feel like there's enough to go around. It's cool.
I'm staying out of this conversation entirely.
Fair enough.
But going back to what you were saying, Laura, about doing Laura Ann. It's Laura Ann? Is that what you
Laura
prefer?
Ann.
Okay. Going back to what you were saying about doing multiple things at once, I mean, I know that I think Sean is correct. All of us tend to bounce between different things. I'm recording this podcast right now. Earlier, I recorded a narration for Pseudopod, which is a fiction podcast. I also wrote some fiction of my own and did some editorial work for Strange Horizons. So that's in one day, I've done four different kinds of things. And that is, I think, natural. But I'm wondering for you, particularly with doing creative projects that are different, can you actually focus on two different kinds of fiction in the same day?
I can. It's not easy. For example, right now I'm working on a fantasy project and I'm on deadline for the next mystery novel. And I'll spend most of the morning, which is my main writing time, is the morning. I will spend most of that on the thing that's on deadline. So I've been working on the mystery. And then when I switch over to work on the fantasy, a lot of times the stuff that's been going on in my head for the mystery, where am I going to take the scene next, is still in my head. And I can't quite get it out. And that slows the work down on other things.
Do you do both of those things in the same writing session, or do you just take a break to do dishes first?
Yeah, I separate everything out completely. I have to, for my own sanity's sake. Otherwise, I have a situation where I was writing two fantasy novels at once, and I started to use the wrong magic system in one.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
You just start looking at the keyboard going, no, that's not how that works. Wait a minute. Back up. And so, yeah, I will actually separate it out, usually by a couple of hours. My afternoons tend to be administrative work, whether I'm doing editorial or dealing with the inevitable paperwork that comes of I've been a freelancer now for a decade, so there's a lot of stuff that has to get done. And then I will write again in the evening. And that usually gives me enough time. If I find if it doesn't, I don't push it. If my head is still in one project, then that's what I focus on. If I'm on a really tight deadline for something, everything else gets pushed to the side, and I focus on that entirely.
Paul?
Yeah, we still haven't gotten to Heart of Briar, I'm sorry, but I was curious something you were saying earlier about going into fantasy and pressing the Y button, so I'm a little surprised that you went into mystery with the L.A. Kornetsky colored series. So what drew you to actually start tackling mystery novels?
Well, the short version is my editor called me up and said, so you want to write me a straight mystery novel? But I've been writing mysteries anyway. The PSI series are mysteries. The Retrievers series is more of a caper novel set up with mysteries. I was just doing them in a fantastical world. Mystery is about asking why. It's not just who done it. It's why done it. It's about the psychological buttons that make people commit crimes, whether of passion or of greed or whatever. It's all about why.
Yeah, that's one of the things my grandma really likes about she watches the heck out of BBC, like old mystery like TV shows, and she's always like, you know, if I'm reading the books or I watch the shows, I already know who did it within the first 5 minutes of the show. What I care about is why they did it and how the good guys catch them, you know, whatever crime's being committed, because like for her she catches on, and that's the excitement for her, is seeing how it unfolds as a result.
Somebody once said that there are two different types of mysteries, and they broke it down to basically, are you a Agatha Christie fan with the timetables and the all the hints and figuring it out, or are you more for, I'm blanking on her name, the Lord Peter, Dorothy Sayers, who is all about the personality and the characters and why did they do it. And I definitely fall into the Sayers category, yeah.
Interesting. Julia?
Yeah, okay. So actually, this kind of ties in really neatly into a question that I had for you about Heart of Briar. Earlier, you mentioned that you drift toward fantasy because things like romance have more of a formula. I'm a longtime romance reader, and for me, when I read romance, one of the reasons why I read it is because I like seeing the character's journey. It's not a question of who's going to get together, because you know that within the first couple of pages. It's why and how. So it's a lot like mysteries, and I actually really love mystery shows, just like your grandmother, Sean. I spend a lot of time watching them, and I've been spending like the last 2 years trying to get to the point where I actually can most of the time reliably guess who is going to turn out to be the killer. because everyone tells me, I've been through this sort of like writing school type thing multiple times where people say, I'm going to explain to you how Hollywood mystery plots work, and that will ruin every mystery show for you. And for the first 5 or 10 years, that just didn't happen for me. I was still clueless. But I'm getting to the point where I finally am, and I still find that I enjoy the mysteries because I like learning why and how. And that's the same kind of way that I engage with romance. So even though there is kind of a formula in place, it doesn't matter. But what was interesting to me in Heart of Briar is that when I opened it, I didn't know anything about it. And I saw that the publisher was Harlequin Luna. And I thought, oh, is this going to be a paranormal romance? And it's not exactly. So, which is fine because I enjoy fantasy as well. But I wondered if you would be willing to talk a little bit about what the Harlequin Luna line is and how Heart of Briar fits into that. And is it secretly a romance?
Luna is basically the fantasy imprint of Harlequin, which was started 10 years ago now because Staying Dead, my first Retrievers novel, was one of their first titles. To showcase fantasy with strong female characters and a romantic interest, but not necessarily to be romance, which I think always sort of sat uneasily with Harlequin because these books, the majority of the Luna books, are not romances. They have, I used to joke that I write relationship fantasy rather than romantic fantasy. The Portals duology, which is Heart of Briar and Soul of Fire, which comes out in October, have romance at the heart of them because it is a retelling of Tam Lin, which is about a woman's struggle to take back her boyfriend who was stolen by elves. Not destroying the plot to say that. So at the heart, it's about heart. It's about romance. It's about love. And in that regard, yes, it is a romance. But it also isn't, because there isn't necessarily a guaranteed happily ever after at the end. They might have a happily for now. But I tend not to tie things up in nice, neat little strings, which for a traditional romance, the reader really expects and sometimes demands. They are, I guess they're romantic in a lot of ways, in both the lowercase and the capital R sense, but they're not romances. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I mean, I have to say that it did have romantic elements in it. I would definitely agree with that. It wasn't straight up what I would expect out of a romance novel, though. There wasn't a neat little bow tied up at the end that said, okay, everybody's happy, we're done.
There never is in any of my stories. If there's one thing that's consistent, it's that there's no neat bow whatsoever.
That's actually kind of sometimes a good thing, because if you watch a lot of kids' shows, everybody's happy at the end. Well, except for Pixar. Pixar's different. Because at the end of like Toy Story 3, I was like, wait, what just happened to my soul?
Sucked out of you.
Because it doesn't end the way you... It's like, it's kind of happy, but it's not really.
The push should always be to have a satisfying ending, not necessarily a happy ending.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. And Toy Story 3 does have at least a satisfying ending, yeah.
And I think that it's, as a romance reader, when I'm reading romance, I am looking for that happy ending, because usually when I come to read romance, it's to de-stress. Mm-hmm. And I want to know that everything is going to be okay. That's very soothing. But when I'm reading something else, I'm not necessarily always looking for that. I read a lot of things that don't end well.
I see, Paul, you had your hand up, so why don't you jump in?
I did. Actually, one of the things I did want to talk to Lauren about was the connection to Tam Lin. As I was reading Heart of Briar, I was going on, and then there's the scene where it's described what Jan has to do to get him back. I thought, this is Tam Lin. Damn! it just clicked, and I was hesitant at first. Is this a secret? Or how open are you about this? I was worried that this was a reveal in the way that you were telling the Tam Lin story. So why retell the Tam Lin story? What's the importance and power of this story that you wanted to recast it in this way?
I think because, and God knows, Tam Lin has been retold brilliantly before, and it was kind of intimidating for me to even think about going up against the previous retellings. But I felt that I had an interesting take on it or a twist on it in my own mind, talking about this love that you can have for somebody that you will go through. You will go through hell. You will go into fairyland. You will stand against any challenge to get them home. But we've seen this happen not just in romantic love. I mean, that's a parental love also, that siblings will do that for each other. So I wanted to play with all the different variations that we have of the love that will stand, the love that will not let go, that will drag you out of danger no matter what the risk. And that's why I was able to bring in a lot of the different characters in the story who aren't in the traditional Tamlin, because I wanted to play with all the different relationships where you commit and you love and you will do anything to keep them safe. So I thought with that in mind that I could have a lot of fun with it. And in the second book, I don't want to give spoilers on that one, but you see a different side of that connection.
Well, and rightly so, based on what happens in this particular book. I don't think you could get to the end of this book and be like, yeah, they're just going to go back to normal. Julia, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I had also not really thought it was terribly a spoiler that it was a Tamlin retelling, just based on the fact that the character's name is Jan, and she has to go into Faerie to rescue her boyfriend, but which is on the blurb. So I thought, oh, that seems like Tamlin, which is great because I love retellings. And I'm always interested to see what they do in new and different ways. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this one is that right up front, and I don't think that I'm really spoiling anything in the book by doing this, since it does happen in the first chapter, we find out that Tyler, Jan's boyfriend, has actually just been cheating on her with this online person that he's met up with. And I thought, whoa, that's a... that's a bold move to take at the beginning of what might be a romance novel. So how did you decide to start your story with that?
Well, the pitch I'd originally given my editor was Tamlin with a geek girl heroine. And I tend to, the joke is I always, like peanut butter and chocolate, I tend to get science in my fantasy. And I wanted there to be a scientific basis for a lot of the magic. Every magic system I've created for any of my books has at its heart a vaguely realistic sounding scientific explanation. In the Cosa Nostradamus, Retrievers, PSI novels, the magic is based on electricity. In the Vineart War, it's based on agriculture. So here I wanted to have a scientific edge to it. And some of what I would talk about is a spoiler, so I'm not going to, but I thought, okay, so what would be the most convenient way for elves, should they want to steal humans, to find them? Well, duh, chat rooms.
Okay, so following on that one, you're kind of getting into the other thing that I was really interested to see how you developed, which is the way that fairy and magic work in this world. You have divided people into natural, supernatural, and preternatural. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how you came up with that idea and how it works?
You stole my question.
And mine.
I have absolutely no idea how I came up with it. It was one of those things that just, it was there in my head. And, well, of course, you've got this and you've got that. And this would probably work a lot better if people could see my hands waving as I'm gesturing. And I could see the breakdown of where everybody went. So there was never a moment where I said, okay, how am I going to work this? It's just kind of like, oh, this is how the world works. But I wanted very much to there to be a separation between the humans, the supernaturals, which is a lot of what we deal with in our fairy tales, the more common, and elves, the sort of ethereal, dangerous, otherworldly characters who never quite seem to me to be as connected to the earth as a lot of other supernatural characters. So that, it just seemed natural to me, and the science then kind of flowed out of that separation. And again, there we're getting into spoiler mode here, so I can't give any more explanation than that. But once I had the idea of the preternaturals as being outside of our world, and how would they connect, and how these portals would open, everything kind of came out of that.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. I thought that was actually one of the more interesting parts of the at least the first chapters, when you learn that there's lots of interesting parts, but like in the first few chapters you actually learn about I think it's AJ, one of your supernatural creatures, who explains to Jan and I think scolds her, if I recall correctly, for not knowing Latin. Didn't anybody learn Latin anymore? And she's like, who the hell learns Latin? That was an amusing moment. But it was really interesting, too, because there almost seemed like there was, if not an explicit hierarchy, there is the way in which the three groups interact, or for that matter, don't interact on purpose, was really interesting, because it suggested there's the kind of different dynamics between the groups. So AJ talks a couple times where he mentions that the supernaturals, as a general rule, just kind of ignore all of the normie people. And the normie people, I'm saying normie, natural people, as a result, tend to just kind of pretend like they didn't see what they saw, because it would be just too freaking weird. And I was really interested in that, when you were designing this or putting this all together, I mean, did that kind of come naturally, or did you imagine that there was actually this kind of complicated interrelation between the groups?
I think in order for that world to exist, there would have to be that kind of complicated relations. When you're overlapping territory, as it were, and your survival depends on not being noticed, and your mental survival for the naturals depends on not acknowledging. Because if you acknowledge something like that, everybody thinks you're crazy. So there are ways you learn to compensate. It's a lot like if you're walking a city and you see a homeless person or you see somebody who's obviously crazy and they're coming to you, you just don't see them. It's protective, not camouflage, whatever the reverse would be, of I don't see it, that's not happening, therefore it can't affect my life.
It's a blindness.
Healthy, yeah. But it's useful.
I was just thinking as you were saying that yeah, that's true for the most part, except for the people who get TV shows on sci-fi, who are actively trying to find them. But in some sort of strange way, I guess in your world, their desperation to find the supernatural thing, whatever it may be, they end up just missing it. Because ironically, at least in the world you presented, they're kind of just around, like in plain sight, but nobody seems to notice.
Well, some people do notice, but they tend to be co-opted, just as Jan ends up being co-opted into this world where once you know about it, you can't go back. But you're also not going to be talking about it to anybody.
Oh, because you sound like a nut.
Yes.
I met a goblin. His name was Ted. one of the other creatures I actually really wanted to ask a question about, and I was just really happy when I read it, that your gnomes are flesh eaters. and I got a little bit of like a gleeful joy when I read about that, when AJ is telling us that and the gnomes first show up, at least in the early book. I got really joyful because I've never really trusted gnomes, to be totally honest. And I say this having watched it. I don't remember if anyone remembers the show. I believe it was called The World of David the Gnome. It was a cartoon show from like it came out in the late 80s, and then it like played on Nickelodeon in the 90s. Nobody remembers it. I'm the only one that remembers the show and has nightmares about it, apparently.
I remember the show, Sean. You don't give us a chance to talk.
Sorry. I just never thought that was a realistic portrayal of gnomes. They're just too nice.
That's a wonderful phrase.
So
it's not realistic in the same way that Barney is not a realistic portrayal of dinosaurs.
Well, see, I disagree. Like, I think if dinosaurs could sing, they would.
And you think they'd just be like, happy friends time and never, I'm going to eat you because you look like tasty food?
That's the version of reality I like. So, just teasing. But I don't know if that was... what made you decide, I guess, is just kind of a silly way of asking it. Why make them flesh-eating and kind of evil?
Well, I don't think that they are evil. I think that they're self-serving and selfish.
Fair enough.
But they're not evil. And we get to see a lot more of them in the second book, for good and for ill. I chose gnomes because I wanted something that was otherwise innocuous. That a lot of people... oh, gnome. Yeah, you put it in your garden. First of all, those garden gnomes are freaky as hell. But I wanted something that you wouldn't think necessarily would be a threat, because those are always the best threats. Something that is quiet and maybe a little weird, cute or whatever, and then all of a sudden turns around and eats your face. I came out of the horror field, so this is a natural thing for me to look for the most seemingly harmless thing and make it be the most dangerous thing.
And gnomes would be it.
Gnomes would be it.
Those creepy little...
My gnomes are distinctly creepy. They creep me out.
As they should. They're so weird. Well, I'm glad there'll be more gnomes in the next one, because I think at some point we need like a horror movie that's about, you know...
flesh-eating gnomes.
Yes. I think we need it. We had Leprechaun. I mean, we had like 9 Leprechaun movies. He went to the hood. So why can't we have a gnome movie?
From your mouth to somebody's in Hollywood's ears, yes.
Yes. Make me a scary gnome movie. It'll probably be Norwegian, though. Because they're making the best horror movies these days.
They did Trolls, yes.
I see Paul had his hand up. Why don't you jump in, Paul?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about Jan. I noticed, Lorraine, you made her an asthmatic. You basically gave her, in a sense, a disability. I was curious what prompted you to do that.
Because I have a lot of friends who are asthmatic, including my sister, and there always seems to be a sense of them of, well, I could never be an action adventure star. I wouldn't survive, yada, yada, yada. And I thought that's ridiculous. I think it's past time for an asthmatic heroine. That was very much a conscious choice on my part to say, this is something that a large portion of the population deals with. So why wouldn't it chance fall on an asthmatic to have this adventure? That could be fun. And it also, it informed Jan's character, who she is very much wound up in her, I don't even want to call it a disability, the adjustments she has to make for her asthma.
Disadvantage in the role-playing sense of the word is probably better than disability. I withdraw the word disability.
Well, I'm an asthmatic, so it can be essentially a disability if you have it bad enough.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I would be out of school for a whole week because I would have these massive asthma attacks. And like we couldn't fly anywhere or go anywhere because we had to take without my nebulizer, we had to take it with us everywhere. This little machine that would, you know, for the breathing treatments. Nowadays, I don't think they'd let me take that machine on the airplane.
No, don't think they. Yeah, you have to check that sucker.
Yeah.
But the one thing I was doing when I was doing research on asthma, because I don't actually have it, I talked to a lot of people and it seemed there was this massive range, not only in the symptoms, but what triggers it and how people deal with it. So I felt comfortable sort of messing with that and taking some things and dropping others. Obviously, the more severe, the less likely you are to be able to, you know, kick a monster's ass. But and she manages it.
Yeah, and I think you did a pretty darn good job of presenting asthma. And I say this as somebody, like, I get really annoyed when I see a movie and they just show a character with an inhaler and they just go poof, and then, like, you know, where they just suck it in like for like half a millisecond and let it out again. It's like that's not how you use an inhaler. Anyone with asthma would tell you you're an idiot. Like, that kid didn't get any medicine. So,
well, I'm glad it passes muster because I was very nervous.
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job. So, you know, there were no red flags I was reading and going, that's not asthma. So, unlike Hollywood, which can't even... I should be a consultant. I should be an asthma consultant in Hollywood. They should pay me like $500 every movie that has asthma in it.
Just $500, that's all?
Well, they put asthmatics in movies all the time, and they get it wrong every time.
I know, I'm just saying it's Hollywood. They could probably afford to pay you more than $500.
I'm not a gnome. I'm not selfish. Sorry. Okay, so where did my question go? Well, one of the things that we kind of mentioned it because, of course, you said that you're doing a take on the Tam Lin story, and I don't know if this is now even a relevant or perhaps a good enough a good question to ask, but it was one that jumped out at me as while reading this is, you know, we've had a lot of discussion, at least in the last year or so, about the trope of like the damsel in distress, and here obviously that the tables are different. And I'm not sure if that was something that you had originally thought of, or if that you were doing, that you were reversing the tables, or if it just became part of the territory when you were sort of taking the Tamlin story.
I think I pretty much built a career on not having damsels in distress. I don't like to describe my characters, female characters, as kick-ass, because a lot of times they can't. Jen, perfect case in point. But they're certainly capable of getting themselves into and out of trouble on their own. And in this case, everything is triggered by the guy getting himself in trouble because he wasn't thinking with the big head.
No.
And you understand why as the story goes along, but it was very much her going in and saying, well, I have to do this. I'm the only one who can do this for X reason. Not because I'm a hero, not because I'm better or smarter. It's just I happen to be the right person in the right place at the right time. So I don't know. I don't know if it's reversing the trope so much as just there was a phrase that used to come up in left fandom called competence porn, which is watching capable people do their thing, which is amazingly sexy. And I like writing characters like that. People who find their groove, find their competence, and run with it, even if they're not entirely certain as they're doing it. And that more than reverse tropes intentionally was what I was doing. Where was Jan's strength? What can I do with this? And how can I show it? I mean, she has her ass rescued a few times, too, in the book. She does not say, I don't need help.
Sorry, Paul.
Yeah, that was just a reaction. Sorry. Go ahead.
So that leads into something I noticed while I was reading this book, is that it's a really ensemble cast book. If you think about the Tamlin myth, you don't usually think about the other people who are going along with Jan and guiding her through Fairy and helping her figure out what to do and sometimes saving her when she gets into too much trouble. But you have some really interesting other characters that are kind of acting alongside her, and they need her to help rescue Tyler, but they have strengths that she doesn't. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you chose to create those characters and what myths you were drawn to and why, and how you came up with your ensemble cast.
How and why? Everybody, I mean, I've read the hero's myth. It's sort of required if you have been writing fantasy for any period of time, I think. And honestly, I think a lot of it's bullshit because nobody does it alone. You know, you go through all of these stages, you go through all these adventures, but realistically, nobody does it simply by the sheer sweat of their own brow or their own wonderfulness. There's always help. I'm a writer of a certain age. One of my formative movie influences was Labyrinth. And if you watch that movie, she gets all sorts of help. Admittedly, it's from Muppets, but still. and that's how she succeeds, by people reminding her of who she is, where she is, what's important. And that's what I wanted. That's what I want in all of my stories, actually, is, yes, you might have a hero, but they're not acting in a vacuum. They don't live and die in adventure alone. There's always something pushing and surrounding them, and that is other people, for various definitions of people. So when I said, okay, you know, this is what Jan's going to be in, who drags her in? Well, it has to be somebody who knows about this. So that is where AJ and Martin first came in. And they just, the moment I put them on page, their voices just flowed. They were quite a lot of fun to write. And all the other characters came in as I was writing the scenes very organically. At no point did I say, okay, this is where I need X or this is where I need Y. It was, okay, this is the scene. Who's in it? Who's going to help her? Who steps forward? And it, usually then the question, of course, and who dies? Unless somebody dies. So I can't, I wish I could say, you know, this is how I did it or this is why I did it, but they just, as I'm telling the story, the characters appear and step forward and say, this is my turn now. Which is a deeply unsatisfying answer, but the only one I can give.
Well, that's all right. So I don't think that it really is a spoiler to talk about what kind of a creature Martin and AJ, kind of creatures they are, because we meet them pretty early on. So I guess I wonder, have you been fascinated with any particular kinds of creatures before? Were these particular choices, did they surprise you, or were they something that you thought, oh, of course I would choose that because I've always gravitated toward horses or wolves?
No, Martin was actually originally intended to be a lot darker, as befitted a Kelpie who basically kills people for a living. But he developed a sense of humor. That surprised me. I really wasn't expecting that.
He was a very fluffy Kelpie.
He's incredible. He's a borderline sociopath, but he's not a malicious sociopath. In that he really, when he can bond with somebody, he will quite strongly. It's just he doesn't think to. Feckless is probably the best way to describe him. AJ, oh, bless him. AJ may be my favorite. I wanted AJ as a leader because of the pack mentality, the werewolf mindset, the protectiveness, the leadership, the alpha male. I needed all that for the main mover on the supernatural side. And I wanted him to be very much an unsexy werewolf. You know, this was not going to be, you know, ooh, potential love interest. AJ's he's a son of a bitch and he's not particularly attractive, but he is so much fun to write and definitely somebody you want at your back always.
Definitely.
Well, I have to say that Martin kind of reminded me of John Cusack's character in Gross Point Blank. There's a point in that movie where his love interest is like, you're a sociopath, and he's like, no, sociopaths kill for fun, I kill for money. And I thought, I can really imagine Martin saying this.
Writing the scenes of Martin and Jan interacting, where she periodically has to remind herself that she has to be careful, she has not do certain things to trigger him. He is a killer. This was an interesting thread to play with throughout the book, because on one hand, they're partners and they're friends. And at the same time, she absolutely cannot trust him. So that was an interesting balance to play.
Yeah, I like that little mix of, you said you toned it down, but that little mix of potential darkness and Martin, like, yeah, if Jan does the wrong thing, Martin's going to drown her, and that's going to be the end of it.
And he won't feel bad about it either. It's just a thing. It happens.
Right.
He might feel a little bad.
I don't think he would. No, I really don't. Not after the fact.
You got to remember, this character's in her head. She knows him.
It's true.
Which makes you wonder about my head, doesn't it?
It's making me wonder just a little. No, just... writers are fun that way, because there are some writers who actually say, you know, my characters actually talk to me in my head, and then you read their books and you go, that character's talking to you in your head? Really? That's a little disturbing.
I can honestly say that very few of my characters talk to me in my head. They talk to me through the computer. Well, that may not be any more reassuring.
That's a
no,
little
definitely
bit more.
Not considering the subject matter of this particular book.
I think it's a little bit more reassuring, you know.
Okay.
She's not going around having Martin and AJ have conversations in her head.
Think about what she just said. Her characters talk to her through computers. And then think about Tyler.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No.
Basically, if I'm not typing, they tend to wait their turn. There, does that make you feel better?
A little bit, but now I don't know.
Oh, dear, I freaked out the hosts. Actually, that's a good thing. I'm proud of that.
Well, this actually, the kind of reference I didn't catch for a minute, actually brings me to a question I was very curious about with Ty, because he actually remains one of your POV characters, and primarily to kind of show us what is going on in his neck of the woods, which is, by that I mean, not very happy things are happening to him. And I was really interested by these scenes where we're not 100% sure what, at least for me, it was very surreal what's kind of happening to him physically. But it's very clear that he's being like put through effectively like elf torture, and very horrible things are being done, and he's feeling a great amount of pain. And I thought it was really interesting that in the process of this, he's sort of being pushed and prodded to give in to these elf creatures. And it's almost as though, like, in some sort of weird way, there's almost like a commentary about Stockholm syndrome there, because of course he is technically kidnapped, and manipulated and then put through these kind of horrible things. And there's this like really weird kind of disturbing tension between the elves who are trying to manipulate him through this sort of painful process. And I don't know if that's something you had thought of, but I was wondering if you could talk about these kind of scenes and what was, you know, putting together the stuff that was going on with Ty.
Oh, it was very definitely intentional. The plan throughout the entire duology is that Ty is being brainwashed. He is being forced to cut emotionally and mentally all of his ties with this world. They have a purpose and a use for him and all the humans that they've taken. And we see a lot of the fallout of that in the second book. As we were saying before about there is no happy ending. No, there's definitely more going on with Tyler. Writing those scenes was really intense. A lot of times I had to stand up and walk away from the computer and go do something else, because I had done a lot of reading on brainwashing techniques, on kidnapping reports, on cults, and the kind of thing that is done mixed with the approach of the elven world, the myths, the stories about people who allegedly were there. And I mixed all that together into something that got a little dark and a little unnerving, even to the writer. But it was all for a purpose, because he had to go through all of that. There had to be real risk, had to be real damage. I'm a firm believer that every story has to have real damage. Otherwise, you're pulling your punches.
Yeah, and in his case, he's going through some particularly nasty damage, because it's not just physical; it's mental. Which, you know, I mean, you could heal wounds, but it what, you know, the things that go bad in your head, that can take maybe even forever to fix, if they can be fixed at all.
And that's one thing where the original Tamlin legend I always felt was lacking, because it ends with a happy ending, and I'm thinking, oh no, I don't think so. You don't go through any major event in your life without there being fallout, and it's a lot of this, the genesis of this thinking and this story for me probably goes all the way back to 9/11. Just being a bystander in New York City changed me. So how can you not go through a major traumatic event, and whether you're a bystander the way Jan is at first, or if you're involved the way Ty is, how does that not change you for the rest of your life? I've worked this out in a couple other stories before, but it was very much central to the idea of what he's going through here.
That's actually a really, really interesting example. I say that because I'm teaching a lit class this semester, and I'm actually going to be teaching a post 9/11 novel by Don DeLillo called The Falling Man. And in an attempt to actually explore this very question, because most of my students, they're fairly young. They might have been born before 9/11, but they most certainly weren't old enough to really, like, they were probably affected, but not in the same way that those of us who were, you know, adults or teenagers might have been affected by that moment, because, you know, they were like three when it happened. Or, well, they're not quite three, because it's only 2013. But you get what I mean. Like, they were very young. Maybe their parents didn't really have, like, the conversation with them, because, like, how do you explain 9/11 to a nine-year-old or something? And so it's really interesting at that moment that, in a weird way, even if you were not directly interacting in that moment, like whether you were there or you, like most of us, were, you know, at home watching it on the news, the culture that exists after that moment influences the people that live in it. And so these young people growing up, you know, that they're growing up in the post 9/11 generation, and in a weird way, they've been affected by it without even realizing
it. Like
the great example is, we've already mentioned it before, airplanes. Like, you know, in the old days, you could literally go through security and you, like, you didn't have to have a ticket. You could go sit there and wait for your loved one to show up. Nowadays, you can't even go through without a ticket. So, and among other things, you know, now we've got, like, weird look under your clothes machines, and you can only bring in certain numbers of fluids, and if it goes over a certain number of ounces, it's bad.
There's a certain level of paranoia, absolutely. Yeah. And you can't, again, this is something that in Soul of Fire, our characters have to deal with. It's not the main push of the story, but it certainly is influencing everything that happens, in that Tyler has been stressed and has broken, and everybody else is dealing with it also.
Yeah, in their own unique ways, yeah. That's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out after in the second novel. Which means we're going to have to read it, guys.
Oh, I already have it pre-ordered.
Wow. That's awesome, Paul.
but Laura Ann knows I read lots and lots of her stuff, so she's not surprised.
Yeah.
I don't know. You could just pretend to be surprised. Like,
yeah. Oh, that's so wonderful. Yes.
She's not even excited, Paul.
Actually, I'm very impressed because, you know, wow, I'm slowly weaning him into reading urban fantasy, which is quite the accomplishment.
Well, there's actually something quite good about that. You know, if you found a way to bring somebody who maybe never wanted to read it before to actually start reading a certain genre, that's then actually be a good thing. I wasn't an urban fantasy reader several years ago. I only became one really as a result of kind of this show, with some exceptions prior to that, because we got a lot of urban fantasy requests, and now at least half of the fantasy I read is urban fantasy. Never thought that was going to happen, but it did.
Well, the great thing about urban fantasy is that it is such a huge range. I mean, we tend, you know, urban fantasy bestseller, you've got X category, which is very narrow, but it also expands, you know, what I refer to as suburban fantasy. We've got rural, I like to call it contemporary fantasy more than urban. Anything that's happening in the modern world. And there are just so many possibilities that it seems a shame we don't embrace it more.
Why do you think it is the redheaded stepchild? How has been and still is to an extent. What do you think that is, Lauren?
Because a lot of the urban fantasy, especially early, and certainly the bestsellers, also have heavy romance influence. Because it's seen as a quote-unquote female-oriented subgenre, so there's always been some sneering. And once it became popular, there's even more sneering because there's nothing we love to hate more than somebody who's actually made it. And I include myself in that. We all have those moments. But it's also, I think, science fiction in a lot of ways tends to be a slightly reactionary genre. Mm-hmm. And seeing something new and different and bluntly not boy-oriented necessarily, not directly boy-oriented, put a lot of people off at first. So when people are put off, they sneer because it's a lot safer than showing that you're uneasy about something. Fortunately, I think a lot of people have realized, as you guys have, that wow, this is actually just as much fun as the adventure quest fantasy. It's just as much fun as the science fiction adventure. It's just as much fun as the hard science stuff. It's just different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of one of the things that was going through my head when we were Paul was kind of asking his question and then you started answering was, in a weird way, it's almost like the science fiction fantasy community is still afraid of cooties. Because there's been discussions, too, about what is being called science fiction romance, which is basically just science fiction with a romance plot. Mm-hmm. And most of those novels, at least the ones that I've seen, like you read them and you go, okay, so it makes it a romance because it has, like, love? But they're not, like it seems like in some level, the science fiction fantasy community sees romance as being like the Harlequin romance, when obviously that's not what all romance is.
There's so much more to it, yeah. And it's a shame, because in a lot of ways, romance is a form.
Yeah.
You've got these certain things that happen. Science fiction and fantasy are concepts where you can wrap the romance, or you can wrap the mystery around the concept, or inside the concept, and it gives it a certain structure, but that's not limiting in any way, shape, or form. They blend together really well. Just the same way that science fiction and fantasy mysteries blend together extremely well and always have. They're complementary. And as long as, in my opinion, the concept is the predominant driver, then it's science fiction, then it's fantasy. When romance becomes the driving factor, then it's a romantic fantasy, which is why, as I said, I don't really ever believe I've written a romantic fantasy in that sense, despite being published by Luna, which probably drove my editor insane.
Yeah.
But I am at heart a fantasy writer, not a romance writer.
You've written a little science fiction, but not much. I can think of one science fiction story of yours I've read, and that's about it. How much have you written, really?
Oh, a science fiction short fiction. I've written a decent amount, but in fact, one of my favorite reader comments ever was a story called Apparent Horizon, and the reader said, "This reminds me of Jean Le Carré, and I was like, "Oh, yay!" But science fiction, for me at least, has always been better in the short form. So I'm much more likely to write science fiction under, say, 10,000 words. I can play with ideas more. And then, of course, there was Dragon Virus, which I'm not quite sure how to define those stories. They're science fictional horror, horrific science fiction, something. But very much science fiction. And a lot of people were surprised and kind of like, oh, I didn't know you wrote this kind of thing. I write anything. Whatever comes to my brain, I don't particularly care. I'll write it if it interests me.
That's always a good thing, though. It gives you plenty of stretching room.
It keeps me from getting bored, which is pretty much the driving force of my life.
I think you and Julie would like Dragon Virus, Sean, as would our listeners. You should go get it. It's available at Bookview Cafe. Here endeth the plug.
It is one of the projects of my heart, which proves that my heart is dark and twisted. But, yeah.
Well, this comes from the person who told us earlier that her computer's talked to her through the computer, so it seems kind of normal. I'm teasing. I'm out of questions on my end.
I think we've been talking for about an hour. We should probably...
just about.
Head into our wrap-up section. Not that I don't think the book is great. I just don't know how to talk about it anymore without spoiling.
Well, yeah, it is problematic.
Yeah. Well, we could spoil everything. We just tell the whole plot. No, not going to do it, guys.
No, we want our listeners to buy and read the book.
In the end, they all turn into Kelpies, and then they have a pizza party.
They're going to be so surprised if it doesn't turn out that way. I'm sorry, Lorianne.
I haven't had dinner yet. Now I want pizza.
Oh, gosh, pizza sounds delicious, doesn't it?
And she lives in the home of good pizza.
One of the homes of good pizza. I don't want to get fights started with Chicago.
Okay. Oh. Fair point, but you know I'm an expat, so you know where my love lies.
I'm sorry. I live in Florida, so the best pizza I can get is Domino's.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So I don't understand. I'm just going to have to go to these two places and, like, do a pizza test off, and then you'll hear about me in the news having a heart attack from eating too much pizza. So the first kind of the ending question I want to ask is the big one, which we kind of know part of this, but what have you got coming out in the near future? Maybe some convention appearances you could mention too, and obviously do mention again the your second novel for this particular series is coming out.
Yeah, the follow up to Heart of Briar is Soul of Fire, which is coming out the end of September, early October. And let me tell you, getting those books finished in time to have them published that close almost broke me, which is a lot of fun and answers a lot of the questions and raises more questions. I also have the next L.A. Kornetsky mystery, the Gin and Tonic mystery, coming out in October. So October is going to be a busy month for me. That's fixed, which has, I believe we have a sample up on my website, if my webmaster has actually gotten to it. So yay that. In terms of appearances, well, as soon as I finish this, I'm going to start packing for Dragon Con this weekend. God help me. I love Dragon Con. It's where I get to let my geek flag fly, too. But it's always exhausting. It's 4 days of sheer go. And after that, I don't think I'm doing anything until Catclave and then World Fantasy in October, because I have books that are due in between now and then. And my editor likes me to actually, you know, occasionally write. Silly her.
How long does it take you to write a book, generally?
Oh, that totally depends on the book.
Because you mentioned that it nearly broke you getting these two books done in time to have them released so closely. So I was just wondering.
A fantasy novel, urban fantasy, with the amount of research that I have to do, takes me about 9 months from start to manuscript that I'm ready to hand to my editor. A mystery, about 6 months. The epic fantasy, like the Vineart War, oh God. I managed to do each book in a year, but I would rather never do that again. And the problem is I'm writing several things at once. And while I'm writing one thing, I might be doing revisions on another, working on page proofs of a third, so I don't get to spend all day working on something. So there may be times when I have to put a project aside for a week while I'm dealing with other rush deadlines. So it's hard for me to say exactly how long. If somebody would give me a massive amount of money and say, go write a book, I could probably put together a research-intensive 100,000-word manuscript in 6 months without killing myself. But that's not doing anything else.
So basically, you need like a rich person.
I need a patron. If there's anybody out there who wants to support a writer, let's talk. Yeah, definitely need a patron.
And you're a freelance editor as well.
Yes. So I've also got that going on the side while I'm doing everything else. I tend to be a little busy. And somewhere out there, somebody's laughing hysterically. I can hear them. Yeah, I overbook my life.
But being busy is good, though, I think.
Oh, when you're a freelancer, being busy is the best thing ever. It beats the hell out of not being busy.
Oh, I hear you. Yeah, until you become an academic, and then and then you're too busy.
That's why I ran screaming from academia. Too many meetings.
Yeah, I'm not there for the meetings yet, but that's going to happen when I grow up. So, okay,
you're gonna
so
grow up?
I guess I'm technically grown up.
Yes.
But whatever. Anyway, okay, so and we'll make sure everybody knows about that. So people can check out the second book. But where can people find you? That would be the next one.
Well, the website is the good place to start, which I kept it simple. It's laurannegilman.net. Just remember the E at the end of Anne. I'm also on Twitter as L.A. Gilman. Let's see. The other social media is Facebook as very conveniently Laura Ann Gilman. And I've just recently gotten onto Tumblr because, you know, why not? Also, I think it's L.A. Gilman, but it might be Laura Ann Gilman. I don't remember. I keep myself logged in, so I don't have to remember these things like what my name is.
Excellent. We'll make sure there's links to all of that so people can find everything, including all of your other books. So if they check out this one and they like it, obviously they should go check out your other work.
Buy all of them. Buy extra copies. Books make great presents. They're very easy to wrap. Holidays are coming.
That's what I buy everybody. I'm pretty sure everyone in my family hates me.
No, they just have well-stock lobbers.
And really, how can you hate that?
That's true. Well, so thank you, Laura Ann, for coming on the show and talking to us about Heart of Briar and the, I'm assuming, intentionally rhymed upcoming novel, Soul of Fire.
Not intentionally. The titles came to me. I sent them off to my editor, and then I sent a follow-up editor going, oh, shit, did I really do that? And she's like, yes, you did, but we're keeping it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for coming and talking to us. It was great.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Cool. And thank you, Paul and Julia, for joining me.
Absolutely. It was a treat.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Cool. And we'll see everybody next time.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.